to read Back to Reality, the best-selling novel of the Bestseller Experiment by the two Marks, go to bestsellerexperiment.com/back to reality.
And subscribe to this podcast to get loads of extra bonuses. Go to bestsellerexperiment.com/subscribe. Let's run the show. Hello and welcome to the Bestseller Experiment, where we look to write, publish and market a book in just 52 weeks. My name's Mark DeVoe.
And I am Mark Stain. Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Scrivener, for their continued support. Now, today, Mr. D, I use Scrivener in a very fun way because I was on the train, right? No Wi-Fi, not like your fancy Canadian trains. Terrible 3G signal. And I had to check something. And what's a writer to do? You know, if you can't go on your phone and check a visual, it's a visual in particular I was looking for. But you know what? We had it filed away in our research notes on Scriv. Scriv saves the day yet again. Although one thing I will say, it was a picture of some Portaloos. There's a little clue about our book. And I did put a note online about we have a chapter heading, which is at the moment is Portaloo Sunset, which I think was
which
the best chapter.
That's the best chapter heading it.
We've had a message today on Facebook from someone saying the Portaloo and Porter Cabin lawyers have a very long reach, so we might have to change that one. So that's a shame. That's shot down in flames, but we'll have to work around that. But this is part of the fun of social media, I guess.
Absolutely. So if you want to try Scrivener out, please pop along to literatureandlatte.com for your free 30-day free trial where you too can save pictures of toilets in your research folders. So
it's what it was made for.
Mr. Stay, it's been quite a week. We're rushing towards the end of our novel with quite some speed. And
we have been saying that for a few weeks though, haven't we?
We have. No, but it is. It's a rush. It's a constant rush. We never seem to quite get there. We're trying to push hard, but we're getting close. We're getting close.
Endings
aren't we?
Are hard though.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And this week we've got somebody who's in the podcast studio who actually has quite a few interesting similarities between our little partnership that we've got going here, haven't we?
Yes. The big difference is she's a huge best-selling author.
No, I'm looking for the similarities. Let's focus on the similarities.
Okay. I'm really, really excited to welcome Laura Barnett to the podcast. Now, Laura published a book a couple of years ago called Versions of Us, which was a massive bestseller. And more importantly, it was a debut as well. This was Laura's first book, having previously worked as a journalist, a music journalist. The thing people kept talking about was, how can she write with such depth and emotion? And you're still pretty young as well. It's a book that completely blew people away. But now Laura is back with her second book, that difficult second album, as they say in the music industry. And this book is completely unique. And we're going to find out in a moment. But first of all, welcome to the podcast, Laura Barnett. How are you today?
I am very well. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. Lovely. Now, your new book is called Greatest Hits. Can you tell us about that and what's special about it?
Of course. So yes, new book is called Greatest Hits, and it tells the story of a female musician, a character called Cass Wheeler, who is looking back over her life. It's set over one day in spring 2015. Cass is now 65. She's had a sort of mega career in the mould of kind of Joni Mitchell or Kate Bush. She's kind of a British Joni Mitchell with a bit of Kate Bush swagger and Chrissie Hynde cool.
I like her already.
Yeah, she's awesome. But she's had some tough times emotionally, and 10 years ago she retired from music and shut away her studio, shut it all down and just cut herself off from her life, really, from her career. But recently, in the last year or so, she started writing new songs, and she's decided to confront her past by delving back into her back catalogue over the course of this one day and choosing 16 songs for a greatest hits compilation. So, as I say, the book kind of tracks her through the course of that day, and each song she plays while sitting in her studio in Kent becomes a chapter about how and when that song was written. So we trace the whole arc of her life from birth through adolescence, fame, marriage. I'm not going to say too much more than that to give too much away, but all through from when she was born to her 60s, and join her now and find out sort of how she's going to make sense of her mistakes.
So each song is sort of triggering a memory, that sort of Proustian flashback kind of thing. Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly. There's no Madeleines, unlike Proust, but there is a lot of mineral water and coffee. Exactly that. I mean, the book is really founded my own fascination, and I'm sure one that you guys share, with how evocative music is. I think it's probably the most incredibly evocative and visceral of all art forms. You hear a song and immediately you're transported back to where and when that song first struck you. And if you've written that song, then obviously there's a whole other resonance. And I've always, as a long-time music fan, been fascinated with all those kind of arcane stories about where songs came from and where the lyrics, you know, what they were inspired by. As a teenager, I was obsessed with the Beatles, and I had that book by Hunter Davies that went through every single song, Beatles song, and told you where it had come from. And probably half of those stories were apocryphal, but they were very exciting. But the other thing that's unique about the book is that it comes with a soundtrack. So as I say, there are 16 songs in the novel, each of which has a chapter dedicated to it, and each of which has the lyrics included in the book with a sort of little fake Wikipedia entry about how and when the song was written and who it's produced by. And it was clear to me pretty much from the beginning that I wanted those songs to exist in their own right, to exist, have a life beyond the page, and actually exist as an album. So not being much of a musician myself, although I'm a huge music fan, I've worked with the singer-songwriter Catherine Williams to produce an album, which she has released the day after the book.
It's a fascinating story, Laura. I'm really, really interested, being, you know, from the music industry myself, and having, you know, working with an author. It's almost like we've done this slightly in reverse. But what was the thing that drew you to want to do this? Was the idea for the album to go along with the book something that you had in your mind before you started? Or did that happen once you started writing the book?
They more or less came together. I remember the idea for making a soundtrack album to a book came to me on the M6 on a long drive back from Scotland, that very glamorous road. We can call it the new Route 66. My husband's Scottish, so we spend a lot of time on motorways, and I don't drive yet, so he drives and I sit and think. And I was sitting and thinking and looking out of the rain, and it just occurred to me that there could be such a thing as a soundtrack album to a book, and that this would be a really exciting new way of bringing together two art forms. And I think that probably came out of 12 years that I spent as an arts journalist covering all sorts of cultural collaborations, what we might call crossover projects. You know, I remember interviewing Ray Davies about working with a choir, or, you know, choreographers who'd work with visual artists. And my husband used to be an actor, and he used to act with Secret Cinema, who obviously do theatrical immersive experiences around film. So it felt like there was this kind of ferment of activity between art forms, but that literature, which is probably my primary love alongside music, was still a kind of case apart. And obviously reading is quite a solitary experience, but the new digital formats and audiobooks and everything really give us a chance to take reading to new places and to make it expand the experience really beyond the page, as I say. So that immediately struck me as an exciting possibility. And then it was a few months after that that my agent was just about to send my debut novel, The Versions of Us, out to publishers, and she sort of said, so are you working on anything else? And I was like, well, no, this is like my life's work that I've poured into it. And but I sat down and thought about ideas, and then had this idea of a book about a musician, and then the two just seemed to fit together. So yeah, it was a kind of convergence of various ideas at the same time.
That's fascinating. And did you find that when you started writing, did you sit down with Catherine and actually write the songs with her, or did you give her a background to the songs? How did that work?
Well, actually, Catherine didn't come into the process until a little bit further down the line, because although I pitched the idea to the publishers from the beginning as having a soundtrack, I didn't even quite know at that stage when I'd want to involve a musician. I didn't know which musician it would be. I was quite open. I didn't know at that stage that she would definitely need to be female. That became clearer to me as I wrote. So I'm not a writer who tends to plan in meticulous detail. I like to take a premise, a concept, a character, and then sort of get to know her or him over the course of the novel, really, as you would a person in real life. I don't like to decide everything about this character in advance, because I like to give them room to surprise me. So it felt pretty obvious that I would need to write a draft of the whole novel before approaching a musician, because partly because I just wanted to know what was going to happen and what I was presenting them with, really. So I wrote first drafts for the lyrics for all 16 songs along as I wrote that first draft of the book. So I wrote what I was sort of thinking of as holding or embryonic lyrics for each song. And that was partly because I needed to work out how each chapter would then express itself in song. So sort of I had to live the experiences with Cass, the character, before I could write a song about it. So I had the whole draft before I approached Catherine, who I'd been a fan of for years, and then heard her on the radio on Six Music, Kerith Matthews' show, talking about her last album, Hypoxia, which was inspired by Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. Here's a musician who's already thinking about how to express music and literature. This is a kind of natural synchronicity here. So I literally fired off an email to her publicist at One Little Indian from my sort of journalist days. I had an email address knocking about, and he came back saying, oh, this sounds like something she'd be up for. And she was. She rang me the next day and we just sort of spoke for half an hour and got on really well. And I was like, where do you live? Have you got kids? And we just sort of did all that. And then she said, you know, I've no idea how this is going to work. It sounds totally impossible. So let's do it.
and I like that's the what sound we did. Of that. That's brilliant.
Yeah. And then a few weeks later, you know how you decide on something and then life kind of tends to throw, I suppose it tends to either throw a spanner in the works or kind of help you. And life did the latter for in our case. So she was doing a gig. She lives in Newcastle, but she was doing a gig down the road from me in South London. So I went along and she then came to stay at my house, and we'd never met at this point. So she just sort of rocks up at my house after the gig at like 11:45 being like, hello. And I gave her a glass of wine and she stayed in our spare room. And the next day we sat down, I handed her an A4 page composed on Scrivener, I'm happy to say, which is actually what I happen to write in. I genuinely am a Scrivener
bonus
fan.
Bonus points for Laura.
I'm always talking about Scrivener. They really ought to be sponsoring me, I'm telling you. Anyway, I handed her this A4 page, which had the lyrics on for a song called Common Ground, which is the first song in the book and the first song on the album. And I just said to Kath, you know, these are lyrics I've written. This is what the song's about. My character is this age when she writes it. It's inspired by this. She's listening to this. It's late 60s. So it's kind of that, you know, that kind of early singer-songwritery, acoustic-y, Nick Drake-y kind of vibe. And she was like, she picked up a pencil and was like, okay, how brutal can I be with this? And I was like, just go for it. Be absolutely free. So she started moving things around. And she just started to sing. And as far as I was concerned, it was as if she was taking dictation from somewhere. I mean, the song just emerged, like more or less fully formed. It was a very emotional moment, and I started to cry, and then so did she. And yeah, there were lots of tears and then hugs, and we sort of knew then that it was going to be okay.
I hope you didn't. I hope you didn't ruin the songs though with all that water flooding all over the paperwork.
Common Ground is the only song I've heard so far from the album, and it is gorgeous. You're absolutely right, and it is a very sad song as well. From what I can gather, there's a mother, there's a daughter, there's sort of themes of abandonment. I don't want to give too much away, but it is one of those songs you just connect straight away. I have to say, it went around the office here at Orion, you know, oh, here's the first song, like, I'll have a listen. Well, I've now downloaded all of Catherine's back catalogue. You know? So I've listened to so much of it. It's just amazing. Now, once you'd heard Catherine's songs, you had another draft ahead of you. How much of your book changed as a result of the songs themselves?
Well, I did have the book was pretty much there by the time I approached Catherine. I mean, I went through lots of drafts, as all writers do, you know, refining and improving and getting to know the character better and sorting out plot points and all that sort of stuff. But music wise I'd been quite careful not to be too specific about how the music sounded, so that I could be open then to how the music actually did end up sounding. So once we had the songs written, I did go back in and rewrite some descriptions in order to reflect the songs that we'd actually written. And actually some of that happened really quite late on, because the publishing process is obviously a lot longer form than the music making process. So we worked together over the course of about a year to write the songs, but then actually recording them and arranging them, which was done by the most amazing man called Romeo Stoddart, who's a composer and producer from the Magic Numbers, the band. And he is just such a knowledgeable and amazing man. And he just worked amazing wonders in this studio down in Eastbourne, where they have a lot of analog equipment, so we could get the kind of right sound for the different decades. So various things happened during that process that then influenced the book. So, for instance, there's a song called Edge of the World, which is one of the newer songs that Cass, the character, has written. And it's a very, very key, very, very emotional song about this big tragedy that strikes her. And I won't say any more than that. But in the book, I had a chapter where this song appears in Cass's mind in the middle of the night, and she goes out to her studio in her slippers and nightgown, and she takes her Martin guitar down off the wall and like strums out this song. So one morning I arrived in Eastbourne in the studio, and Romeo and Kath were looking slightly sheepish, and they were like, yeah, we've done a first take of Edge of the World. And Romeo's ended up playing piano rather than guitar. So we just kind of want you to have a listen. And I was a bit like, not sure about that. But then they played it to me, and it was just the most astonishingly beautiful rendition. And it was like the piano part sounded all kind of languid and like, you know, the washing of waves against the ocean against the beach, which is a big theme of the song. And I was just like, right, okay, that is the take. And I just changed that section of the book now. So it happens that instead of taking down the Martin guitar, she sits down at her Steinway and writes the song on piano. So yeah, there was definitely mutual influence.
A big theme of the book is the kind of sacrifice that artists, creative people have to make in their lives. Is that something you've experienced, or were you tapping more on those kind of Nick Drake, Carl Sid Barrett kind of figures, or you know, who essentially gave their lives for their craft, if you like? How much of that is you, and how much of that is imagined?
It's a very good question and a difficult one to answer, which is why it's a good question. Yeah, it's always hard to draw the line, isn't it, between reality and truth. I mean, there's definitely a lot of my musings in the book as a woman in her mid-30s, you know, married for a number of years, trying to figure out where, if we can fit kids into the equation. My husband Andy is, as I say, used to be an actor, he's also a musician, so we've got two creatives in a partnership, and it's not always easy to see how people living slightly unconventional lives can sort of make room for children. And there is a big part of the book that draws on Cass's experiences of motherhood and her own sort of ambivalence about becoming a mother. So there is a lot of my working out about these things, which I didn't even realise would be there really until, if I didn't even realise it was there until I'd finished it. So that's me being brutally honest. But I think also I did draw on a lot of true stories of women of this era, you know, everyone from Sandy Denny and people I've already mentioned, like Kate Bush, to Carly Simon, Carole King, you know, so many, Joni Mitchell, all these inspiring women. And so many of them had stories of sacrifice, particularly personal sacrifice. And, you know, there's no escaping the fact that it remains difficult for anyone, but particularly for a woman, to sustain a career at the top of her game in the arts without sacrificing some aspect of her emotional life, whether it's her relationship with a partner or with friends, or perhaps not becoming a mother at all, or losing touch with family. This is a very common experience for all artists. And it was something that, as a journalist, you know, I was lucky enough to spend 12 years interviewing artists of all stripes, and women of that generation, women who are now in their 60s and 70s, were very candid with me about the choices they'd had to make. And also, you know, in reading about women like Joni Mitchell or Carole King, you know, all of them had some story of difficulty with motherhood, whether it was in Joni Mitchell's case, giving a daughter up for adoption, or in Carole King's case, you know, having to take a step back from music, or even just like having her daughter, you know, perched on the piano while she was trying to write. It was the pram in the hall thing. And so all those things came out in the book. And there's me and there's them, and it's hard to know where one ends and the other begins.
Wow, that's just fascinating. And it's so true, isn't it? This idea of sacrifice, something Mark and I have talked about quite a lot throughout the series of this podcast. And it's interesting to hear you talk about this idea of this big question. I mean, we both got kids, so we're just struggling through it as best we can. But to even have to think about that idea of, you know, kids or the career, it's such a huge thing ultimately. So it's an incredible area. Do you find that when you started writing with Catherine, things came up for her as well in terms of those similar kind of ideas of sacrifice?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak for Catherine too much, but we certainly had a lot of conversations. I mean, she found some parallels with Cass and her dilemmas and some differences. I should say that one key decision Catherine took quite early on in our collaboration was that she would wait to read the whole book until we had all 16 songs written.
Wow.
This whole process was a sort of feeling our way in the dark because it had never been done before and we didn't really know how we were going to do it. And so she felt that it was important for her that she was able to live each experience with Cass sort of consecutively without the hindsight caused by reading the whole novel. So if she kind of came in knowing all that would come to pass, it would be like she couldn't actually inhabit the experiences as Cass was living them, if you see what I mean. So we wrote the songs by me giving her this embryonic lyric sheet for each one, and then me telling her about what Cass was listening to and what the song was inspired by, an abstract, and I might send her a couple of paragraphs to illustrate that point. But it wasn't until all songs, 16 songs were written, that Cass read the whole book. And then she told me, yeah, there were things that struck a chord with her. I mean, Kath is a mother. She's a fantastic mom. And actually, she's really inspiring to me as a woman who's managing to do that with a very supportive husband and just making it work. But obviously, she's an awful lot younger than Kath Wheeler in the book. And she's also not a confessional songwriter in the way that Kath is. Kath is... she's a writer like any. I mean, she invents and, you know, it irritates her. And I think she thinks it's particularly something that women musicians get asked, you know, or it's assumed that she must have lived through every experience that is described in a song, whereas someone like Bob Dylan can just, you know, write about a character. And that's what Kath does. Whereas Cass in the novel, it's funny, Kath and Cass, isn't it? There are. Yeah. I will tell you a really funny thing is that I actually had to change the name of my protagonist after Catherine got involved on their collaboration, because in the first drafts, Cass Wheeler was called Cass Williams.
Wow.
And that really would have been one step too close, so I had to change it to Wheeler. But yeah, so I won't speak for Catherine too much, but I think she found some resonances and some differences, and we had a lot of conversations that fed in.
Fantastic.
Now, Versions of Us was a smash hit. I mean, it was one of Orion's biggest books of the last couple of years. What were the biggest lessons you learned from that, and what did you carry over from that to the new book?
Well, the biggest lesson I learned writing Versions was to choose a subject that really meant something to me as an author, which sounds like a truism, but is actually harder than it sounds. So although Versions was my debut, as you say, it wasn't the first novel I'd written. I still have two others in a sort of figurative drawer, they're actually on the hard drive and my computer, that I had, you know, sweated blood over the 10 years between leaving university and seeing Versions get published. And they were tough years. You know, I was working full time as a journalist, which isn't, you know, the calmest of professions. And then I was freelance, and I did this crazy thing of leaving a staff job at The Guardian, which at the time had a no compulsory redundancy clause in the contract, so they couldn't make you redundant. And everyone thought I was insane, but I left because fiction was what I really wanted to be doing and what really mattered to me. And then obviously it was hard paying the bills, being a freelancer, all that stuff. And in the meantime, writing these novels that I think now, looking back, I was writing for a sort of imagined reader rather than for myself. I think... yeah, almost like trying to write to the market, which is probably fine if you're writing a thriller or a sort of, you know, genre novel where that, and I'm not saying that no knowledge of the market is important, it is important, but ultimately a reader can smell inauthenticity a mile off. And Versions, the idea for Versions came out of a quite depressed period when I was 30 and I felt like life was getting a bit serious. And I was just asking myself, like, what am I doing? What am I doing wrong? Why are these books not working? Why can't I get published? And the answer came to me that I wasn't dragging these stories up from the sort of depths of my soul. And so I asked myself, seriously, what did I want to write? And that's when I thought of the idea for Versions, which was the idea of this one couple story told in three different ways across 60 years. Another crazy idea. Mm. And another crazy idea that inspired fear and sense of impossibility and therefore made me more determined to do it. So I'd say I carried that over into Greatest Hits. You know, this story of a woman, a creative woman, having lived this long, apparently successful life with a lot of pain and difficulty behind the scenes, that excited me, as did the possibility of making an album to go with the book.
Goodness me, you don't make life easy for yourself, do you, Laura? I kind of wonder what the third project's going to be like. It's going to be like a kind of a collaboration with Cirque du Soleil or something. You know?
It's funny, I'm in talks with them at the moment. No, yeah, not really.
Sorry,
before they get in touch.
I'm sorry, I've just blown it. But I love this idea of writing from the soul. I think it's something I've been learning as we've been going through this process of writing, you know, for me, the first book, and it is something it's kind of obvious when you know it, but at the time when you start writing, it's not really. So one of the things that I really admire about what you've done is you took that plunge. You actually had a job. You probably had your whole career laid out in front of you as a successful journalist. Was it a case that one day you just woke up and said, I have to do this. I have to follow what I know in my heart is my passion? Or was it more a case of a gradual process where you came to the realization that you really didn't have a choice and that fiction was calling you?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. I mean, I loved my years as a journalist. You know, I've wanted to write novels since the age of five. It's just that when I graduated university, I didn't, you know, I was 21 and I just thought, what on earth have I got to say to anyone about anything at this age? You know, I need to go out and earn a living and live some life first, really, and find out what the hell this is all about. Obviously, the longer you live, the less you realize you know about anything. But anyway, there you go.
Yeah.
So I trained as a journalist and did that and loved it, but kind of knew it was always a means to an end. It was always, you know, the day job in a way. It's just that it's not the easiest day job to combine with something else because you're working 10 or 11 hours a day and, you know, it's quite high intensity. So it was a combination of being increasingly unhappy in the role I was in and a senior colleague at The Guardian, who sort of took me under her wing, really, and said, you know, I can see you're not happy. What is it that you want? And I was like, well, I want to write novels. And she was like, well, why are you in a staff job here then? You should really go freelance. And I was like, yeah, but I've got a mortgage to pay. And she was like, well, you know, we'll sort you out with the contract and we'll sort of figure that out. So she really helped me make that decision. And I'm not sure, I was sort of gently pushed, and I'm not sure I would have done it without that. And I'm incredibly grateful to her. Unfortunately, she passed away a couple of years ago. She was an amazing woman called Georgina Henry. And she was really, yeah, real sort of mentor at that stage. And I think without her help and her belief, I would have found it really difficult to jump out of the nest.
What a beautiful legacy Georgina's left, though, when you think about what's transpired from her kind of mentorship in some ways through what you've
she was a woman of far wider reach and importance than just to me, but yeah, in my own small life, yeah, she had a big impact.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, one of the things that I find really interesting when we're talking about the process that you went through as a best-selling author to begin with was the fact it happened on your first novel, which is quite unusual. Did that take you by surprise, and how did you handle it?
It did, of course. I mean, you know, you'd have to be some sort of crazy narcissist to think that any, to assume that any of this is going
to
happen. Like, you can't take it for granted.
To run a podcast called The Bestseller Experiment, right?
Yeah, here I am sat with two crazy narcissists. Hilarious. The two marks.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, that is a fair point. All right. Just put my foot in my mouth.
No. We've got to explain something. We openly are doing this expecting it to be a complete car crash. So we love it. We love it when people assume we actually think we're going to get a bestseller.
Hilarious. Do they? Oh, dear.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I think the whole thing's fascinating.
How was the experience for you?
The success of it came by degrees. And I was very careful. I think, again, I'm happy this happened to me in my 30s rather than my 20s, because I imagine it can be quite easy to get big-headed and to sort of take everything for granted. Whereas I'm also lucky to have a very brilliant and very pragmatic, straight-talking agent. So, you know, things happen by degrees. You know, she loved the book, the agent loved the book. She said, right, I think editors are going to love the book, but obviously we can't be sure they will. Assume you'll get like 10 grand and then we'll see. And then editors did love the book, and then we had like a 7-way auction. So then you kind of know that, you know, more is at stake here, and then you get to meet people and it just kind of grows. And then these funny people called scouts start sort of getting in touch. These people who research, you know, upcoming novels for TV and film companies, and we started getting people in touch from Hollywood, and then we sold the TV rights before it was published. And so it happened step by step. But even with all of that, you can't be sure that people are actually going to buy it, that it's going to translate into readers not only buying it but loving it. So it came by degrees, and I still very much do not take a thing for granted. And, you know, I've done events with like 4 people in Bradford and, you know, 200 people in Glasgow, and I'm just, you know, I'm as happy at the event with the 4 people because I'm still just really grateful that they're there and they want to talk to me.
Bradford, I had one person.
Oh, really?
And I'm pretty sure it was the Waterstones manager's son who had been shoved in front of me. He had this look in his face of say, oh, Dad, not another one. I think Bradford Literary Festival is an amazing festival if you're doing politics or history. If you're writing fiction, Ben Aronovich had 8 people, I think. So ooh. I felt a lot better of myself. So don't feel so bad about that.
Okay, thanks.
One of the things that was fascinating, you said about the scouts that came around, and that was that happened before the book was published, is that right?
Yeah, so we had a number of TV and film companies interested in optioning the rights for the versions of us. And in the end, you know, again, that was another set of very surreal meetings, sat with people from insert name of film company that I probably shouldn't name, and, you know, talking about how they might want to adapt it. And I just had kept having to pinch myself, really, because you just don't really believe these things are going to happen. And in the end, we did sell the rights to a company called Trademark Films and producer David Parfitt, who are just awesome British, South London based company down the road from me. They made Parade's End for the BBC and Shakespeare in Love and all manner of good things. So, you know, that's still in the offing. It's a slow process, I'm learning. I think Mark knows a bit about that.
Mark's been there, yeah. Just a little, just about half his life, I think, wasn't it? And was there a moment when, you know, when the book started to sell and you obviously knew that something special was happening, was there a moment where it kind of suddenly hit you? Because it must have just felt like a dream as things started to build.
It did. I think I was just remembering, actually, because it's 2 years now since the version of Us came out, and obviously the new book's out, and I was just sort of comparing my experience of publication then with what's happening now. And I remember that because the book sold in America as well, and so for some reason the Americans needed me over there in May, around the time that Versions was coming out here. So I was actually on an overnight transatlantic flight, like the night before Versions came out, which was happened because we had to bring the release date forward by 4 days. I kind of hadn't planned it like that, and I'm not the best overnight flyer, so I had like a really bad sleep on this like uncomfortable, I have to say, economy class flight, obviously. And then I remember landing in Gatwick, exhausted and bleary-eyed, and like taking out my phone and checking my Twitter, and there were like, you know, 100 tweets or whatever, all about, you know, happy publication day, and it was in Stylist magazine, and it was this and it was that. And it was just, I was so tired and excited and euphoric, and it just felt really surreal, like I was sort of still half asleep. And then getting home and sort of trying to have, and I think we had builders in our house as well at the time, so it was just, got home and it was just like brick dust everywhere and like all this stuff in our front garden, and me being like, my dream's just come true, and the builder being like, yeah, can I have a cup of tea?
Very, well, two sugars down. Exactly. Nothing like bringing you back to reality.
Exactly.
It is a very strange thing in that you can build these things up into, this is a moment that's going to change my life. But I think when it actually arrives, it can be a bit pedestrian. It's kind of, because already people will be saying, where's the next one? You just have to keep writing, I guess. I mean, are you someone who writes every day?
No, I'm not. I'm someone who, I write in spurts. I sort of, and there's a kind of rhythm to publication, which I'm learning, because obviously this is only my second, Greatest Hits is only my second published book. But the promotional cycle is so intense, and it's so difficult to get yourself out of the headspace of one book and be writing the other, that I tend to dedicate like a number of months to just sort of promoting the book, the, whichever book's coming out, and doing that. And I did that for the hardback of Versions, and again for the paperback of Versions. And then I'll sort of get back into my writing room and sort of just be very disciplined and get on with writing. So at the moment, it's worked out quite well, because I mean, I'm already researching my third book, but I'm not actually into the writing stage yet, because I don't plan too much. I have to do a lot of research to sort of really immerse myself in the character's world.
And are you always thinking about it? Is it always percolating there in your mind?
It is always percolating. I have learnt that there's a lot of writing that happens below the surface, that happens outside the study. And it's taken me a long time to give myself permission for that. I do a lot of yoga, I go running, and those things are really important, because that seems to be when things consolidate, and when, and also in that 15 or 20 minutes after you wake up and you can't quite get out of bed and you've put your alarm on snooze, that seems to be when characters form and plots form. And so
it's interesting, we had Sarah Pimbrough say a very similar thing, in that she doesn't write every day, but she's always thinking about it. It's always there, bubbling away.
Oh yeah, exactly. So in that sense, I suppose I write every day. If thinking is writing, then I write every day.
Oh, I love that. I love that idea of an excuse now for this 15-minute snooze. I'm going to definitely use that one.
That's fantastic. Is golden creative time. That is really important. Oh. Mind you guys both have kids, so probably you get like little ones coming and jumping on the bed.
Mine are teenagers. They sleep in longer than I do.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But the thought of having a 15-minute lie-in is just, I can't even remember. It's just like a dim and distant memory of
just
my past.
Just explain to your partners that you need it for creativity. I'm sure they'll love it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. On that note, actually, of this idea of the kind of subconscious and things kind of working themselves out, I heard some really cool things, actually. One of them was to write down, if you've got a problem with your book or anything in life, write it down before you go to sleep and let your subconscious work on it, and you often wake up with the answer. The other thing that I read, which is kind of linked to the idea of this snooze thing, is the shower. Apparently because of something called sensory deprivation, when you're in the shower and you've just got the noise of the water coming down, that's why so many people get great ideas
in
the shower.
My God, I always have ideas in the shower. The idea for my third book, which I'm just researching now, came in the shower.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing.
I think I've written half this novel in the shower. It's difficult with a biro. Just,
yeah, I was going to say, don't take your MacBook in there with you.
Oh, don't put that image in my head, Devo.
Sorry, that's just ruined your day, Mark, isn't it?
Going back to greatest hits. Now, the rock world, well-chronicled world, right? And obviously, you're talking about the, you know, analog recording stuff. You've clearly done a lot of research in that. Now, are you prepared for, and it will be men, it will almost exclusively be men who are going to read your book and go, I don't believe they had the 40-watt WEM amps in 1977. I believe they were superseded by the solid-state amplifiers. Are you prepared for that onslaught of nerdy nitpicking?
I am prepared, not least because I am quite nerdy myself and quite obsessive about detail. And I think, having been a journalist, I actually find it quite difficult to allow myself to make things up. So I spend a lot of time researching exactly which model of, like, Fairbright, you know, computer would have been used in this particular year or whatever. Fairlight, I should say. There we go. I'm going to get a green inks already. But it's funny. I mean, I would say one of the hardest things with writing this book was to silence what I would now characterise as a sort of men's chorus of angry rock critics who were there in my head. In fact, they were standing over my shoulder in my study through the entire writing process, telling me that everything I was doing was rubbish and what right did I possibly have to try and do this? And no, they wouldn't, this isn't the right name for a prog rock band of this year or whatever. And I had to silence them. I had to work really hard to do that. And it was actually tough. There were days when their imaginary shouts deafened everything I was doing. And I'm happy to say, I mean, I've met a few male rock critics so far in the interviewing and sort of promotional stuff, and they've all loved it. At least they said they did. So I think hopefully there won't be too much of the Green Ink Brigade.
I think what you went through is probably what Joni Mitchell and Kate Bush and all those other women went through as well. You know, having to, I mean, someone like Kate Bush was doing proper prog, really, in many ways, you know, and I mean, you look at some of the stuff online today and the kind of sense of entitlement, you know, these recent Wonder Woman women only screenings. It was like, well, why aren't there men only screenings? And it's just, oh, for God's sake, you've had it your own way for so long. Just give it a break, give it a rest, you know. It's just so frustrating. But I think, like you say, there's an added element to being a female musician, which men have never had to cope with, yeah.
Sure, and I think it's there as a female author. I mean, we might touch on the fact that the versions of us, which is quite a literary, quite challenging conceptual story, was called chick lit by a number of critics and people below the line. And that surprised me, to be honest, because it just didn't occur to me that anyone would see it in that way. And had I been male and American and called Jonathan Franzen, they wouldn't have done. So it is frustrating. But I would say also that I thought a lot about the rock novel before starting Greatest Hits and wondered why the novel that I sort of wanted to read, which was going to be quite a sort of intense emotional journey through one character's life, a woman, a female rock musician, I wondered why that book didn't exist. And it occurred to me that a lot of the rock novels that haven't been so successful have maybe gone a bit Spinal Tap and getting too obsessed with sort of the detail of, right, you know, too obsessed with pernickety detail. And I did do my research and I did hang it all around what I hope is realist, you know, architecture. But ultimately, this is the story of a person. This is the story of a woman, a human being who happens to have been a musician but could just as easily have been a carpenter or, you know, any other sort of craftsperson or whatever, or a bus conductor, I don't know. It's about how you make peace with your mistakes. It's about how you come to terms with things that have gone wrong over which you had no control, how you forgive yourself for your errors. And in that way, hopefully it becomes, yeah, more about her than about which venue she played at in 1974 or whatever.
I think there are plenty of non-fiction books that go into that nerdy detail anyway, if that's what you're after. And it is that thing which we've heard so many times, haven't we, Mark, from other authors about you do your research, but you don't show your research, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Exactly.
So, Laura, you've got, your book is obviously heavily, heavily steeped around music. And obviously with my background in music, and we started out on this novel thinking, what do we both love? And Mark's Mr. Stay here is one of the biggest music nerds you could ever meet. He actually is that guy he just talked about.
Oh my goodness, I've met my nemesis.
It's true.
You're so much friendlier than I was expecting.
What's really transpired to the book that we're currently writing is that it's hugely influenced by that. There's a huge music theme to what we're doing as well. When you started writing this book, coming from the music journalism angle as well, were there any things that you thought, I have to tread really carefully here, or did you just kind of go for it and just let everything come out?
Well, I was never sort of in the music journalist fraternity, and I use fraternity quite deliberately. There are more and more women now. There's a lot of colleagues of, you know, people like Miranda Sawyer and whatever. Anyway, there's lots of great female music journalists, but I was a sort of more general arts journalist. But I would say, yeah, I mean, I encountered an issue that I'd also encountered with Versions of Us, which is when you set a realist novel across half of the 20th century, well, I certainly like to have real people walk in and out of scenes. And it's something that an author called William Boyd does quite a lot. And he must have been just as careful about it as I then had to be, because I had various real musicians saying and doing things, which the lawyers here at Orion suggested might be better if they didn't say or do anything, because obviously you can inadvertently defame in fiction. You have to be really careful. There was a case, wasn't there, of a French author getting sued by Scarlett Johansson's people for having her as a character. And obviously you can't just go around having people who are still alive doing and saying things, or even sort of being at a party where there might be drug taking happening. So I did have to work hard to ensure that anyone who actually spoke or did anything is now dead, because you can't defame a dead person. So, yeah, you could go through greatest hits and notice that any real people who say or do anything are now deceased. Otherwise, I also, in the end, it's on this borderline between reality and fiction. So I did invent a number of characters who might sort of slightly resemble others, you know, but any resemblance is entirely coincidental. But it was about finding out where it was okay to bring real people in and where it was better to stick with fiction.
We have a real person in our book, don't we, Mark, who comes out of it very well, actually. And this was written, we had an episode with two lawyers, and we spent an hour talking through exactly this. And we went into quite some detail. So you can, I mean, we talked about the hypothetical Keith Richards appearing in our novel. And he says, you know, if you have Keith Richards in your novel and he's being a rock musician and he's maybe drinking and taking drugs, that's kind of on record, you know, that you're fine with that. But if you have him do something terrible, like hitting his wife or something, then you've really crossed a line there. And you just can't do that. But yeah, we do have a real person in our book, don't we? I wonder what the editor will think of that when she sees
it. Yeah, and there's lots of inspired bys. We totally get what you're talking about there, Laura. Lots of inspired by characters.
I can't wait to read your book. It sounds right on my street.
I think you'd like it, actually.
I must admit, it's quite uncanny having this interview, because obviously we've been writing this book for how long now, Mark? It feels like seven months.
Since October, and we're now middle of June. So
have you nearly finished it?
I nearly finished the first draft.
Okay. Great.
And it's a right old mess.
Is it?
And it won't be anywhere near as good as your book. So
let's not make any assumptions, kind as that is.
So, Mark, you've got a question of the week, I believe.
Rhoda Baxter, who at Rhoda Baxter is a regular tweeter with us, and I know she's writing. And this is an interesting one. If you think back to when you were a student or when you were writing those first two unpublished novels, and she just said, any advice or motivation for when you feel like you're talking into the void and no one is listening? And that's going to be a familiar situation for any writer who's, you know, doesn't have an agent, doesn't have any kind of deal, and maybe feels, why am I doing this? Have you got any, were you ever in that situation?
Of course, I'm in that situation all the time. It's a really good question. I would say you have to ask yourself whether you really have to do this. And actually, I'm going to borrow slightly from in my other life as a journalist. I did a non-fiction book of advice for actors. And Matthew Horne, the actor, the comic actor, his primary advice to young actors was don't do it. And it's a bit of a cliche. Other people have said it too, but it's because basically that immediately sorts the wheat from the chaff. Like if you hear that and feel a slight sense of relief and you just want to go and sit on the sofa and watch Netflix, not that there's anything wrong with doing that, even while you are writing a novel, has been known. It's called research. Anyway, if you can be dissuaded, if you can do anything else and be happy, then go and do it because you'll have a much happier life. But if you're just going to do it anyway, despite not being published for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, if you do it because you simply cannot envision a life in which you don't try to make sense of existence on the page, then you just have to keep doing it. And it doesn't really matter whether people buy it or listen to it or read it. Not initially. Ultimately, it will be up to you. If you keep writing for 50 years and can't get published, who knows? You'll decide whether you want to keep doing it or not. But it's just whether you have to keep going. And I think if you're a true writer, then the answer to don't do it will be, well, sod you, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. I also, Rhoda talks about talking into the void. And I think that's an interesting thing, because one of the things, once you are published or once you put something out there, I mean, the first things I wrote that meant anything, really, I wrote a series of plays when I was in my 20s, and I staged them at my local theatre. And for the first time, outside of school drama club or anything like that, you know, stuff I had written was getting feedback, but it's getting it right there and then, mm-hmm. the audience right in front of you. If a joke worked, they laughed. If it didn't, they were dead silent. And there is that thing of hoping to hear back, to get almost validation from your readers, from your audience. And I think for some writers, that can be absolutely terrifying, because you step out into, you know, no man's land, and you can be shot at. You know, you can get one-star reviews or whatever, and the thought of that is kind of terrifying. But I think, you know, it's equally, you'll get great feedback too, I think. And whatever people think of it, it's your voice out there in the world. So keep writing, Rhoda, and we're listening. We tweet you every day, so keep in touch and let us know how you're getting on. And this goes for everyone out there on Twitter who's... we've already had several people tell us that they finished their books because of this podcast, which is just amazing to me. You know, the authors we've had on here giving advice like your good self, and it's on bad days when it's not working, it just lifts you. Absolutely brilliant.
And if you want to be further lifted, we have a very special competition. We have a copy of Laura's incredible new book, Greatest Hits, to give away, which, Laura, you very kindly signed for us. Thank you so much for that.
You're very welcome.
And we also have a copy of Catherine Williams' album, which is called Songs from the Novel, Greatest Hits, to go with it. You can also buy those. If you can't wait, and you don't want to enter the competition, you can actually go to Amazon. I believe there is a double pack, is that correct, Laura, where you can buy a bundle, that's the word, yes, a bundle of both the book and the album, which I think would be an incredible experience to kind of listen. I mean, you could have the music on in the background whilst you read the book, I guess, couldn't you?
Yes, although the audiobook, if you download the audiobook, that has excerpts from the songs as well, so there's that experience too. But I think, yeah, either way, whatever way you want to do it, you can do it. It's great.
Also, can I just give a little shout out for the vinyl version of Songs from the novel Greatest Hits, because it is a thing of beauty.
It sounds like it was made for...
It's really stunning.
Yes.
It sounds like it was made for...
Songs is too many for one vinyl, it turns out. Oh. I didn't think about stuff like that when I wrote the book.
have you asked Catherine that eventually one day she's going to release a Greatest Hits album? What's she going to call that now?
Well, that was actually a conversation she had to have with her record company quite early on. That's why it's very carefully named Songs from the Novel Greatest Hits, because actually Catherine is putting out a big retrospective later this year with like a big box set of her sort of best albums. So yeah, she needed to keep that back for her own career. So that's a perceptive
question. I think as well, what you've done is quite genius, Laura, because, you know, you've collaborated with another artist who both focus in, you know, writing music and writing words, whereas Mark and I have collaborated on the same project, battling it out, trying to work out how to do
that. I don't know how you write. Like, I'm too much of a control freak to allow anyone else into the
So am I.
Are you?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I learned that very early on with Mr. Stay. No, it's a fascinating process, but I think the fact that you can still be really good friends by the end of the process is amazing. Oh, it's brilliant.
He seems to be getting on all right,
One other thing I just wanted to touch on before we end up is that a lot of people don't realise this, but coming from the music world, I think we both appreciate this, and Mark, you probably appreciate this as well, is that writing a song is actually storytelling. And we talk about this idea of flash fiction in writing. And as I've gone through this process more and more and learned so much over the course of this year, I've realised that when you sit down to write a song, you know, there's a beginning, a middle and an end. And it's a bit like writing a flash fiction short story. Have you kind of seen those similarities going through the process with Catherine?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, my life's changed in loads of ways since I met Catherine, not least because she took me along on this really amazing retreat that we did as part of the Durham Book Festival last October with four musicians, songwriters and four authors and poets. And the idea was for us to collaborate and make music together. And so every person that I work with, every new song, we were exploring that very thing about where the line is between fiction and songwriting. And as you say, it's a sort of distillation, isn't it? It's a novel in miniature. And the sort of the songwriters that I love the most, people like Paul Simon, Mark Knopfler, Joni Mitchell, are absolutely, that is what they do. They give you, in the way that a poem does or a short story, they give you the whole life in that one song, don't they?
Knopfler is a fantastic storyteller.
Yeah.
I think he's an English teaching background. I think he was an English teacher at some point.
He is also the loveliest man in the world, I'm just going to say, because we were talking about this before we started recording, weren't we, Mark? I quoted a lot of musicians in the versions of Us, a lesson I have now lived to regret, because it turns out you have to pay them a lot of money in order to quote their lyrics.
Oh, yes.
But I had a line from a song called This Is Us by Mark Knopfler and Emmylou Harris as an epigraph for version. So it sort of set the whole tone of the book. And Mark, I managed to get his email address from somewhere and emailed him asking for permission to quote this. And he was like, yeah, it's fine. Just email me on a Saturday morning. He's like, yeah, no problem. Don't want any money. I'll buy my own copy. Proper wow. Gentleman. We like Mark Knopfler very much.
Fantastic. Definitely. Money for nothing and your checks for free, right? This is perfect.
People are appearing at the door, so I think we might get thrown out of here soon, Mark. So right. I'm afraid we'll probably have to wrap this up, and I could talk for ages about this. Get in touch with us at bestsellerexperiment.com. Now, if you've loved what we've talked about today with Laura, we transcribe all this. We put all this into our Writer's Vault of Gold, which is our free ebook. So just pop along there, sign up to our newsletter, and by return, you'll get a link to download it. Come and join us on social media. We're on Facebook at The Bestseller Experiment, Twitter at Bestseller XP, Pinterest. Now, as I said, if you've written a book and you've got book cover art, come and see us on Pinterest. We have a board there for books by our listeners. So come and join us over there. And we're on Instagram at BestsellerXP2. Laura, where can we find you online?
My website is laura-barnett.co.uk, and I'm on Twitter at Laura_J Barnett, and on Instagram, Laura Barnett Author.
Fantastic. And if you'd like to win a copy of Laura's book, Greatest Hits, pop over to the website, click on the Win tab where you'll find it. And if you can't wait, it's just out on Amazon and other good bookstores, so pop along. And I can't wait to read it, Laura. I'm really excited. So thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you,
having this wonderful conversation. Really,
our pleasure. And in a slight change to our usual programming, we're going to play out with a little bit of Catherine Williams. So it's goodbye from Mark 1.
And it's goodbye this week from Mark 2.
Goodbye! It was